This is Karen Musgrave. I'm doing a Quilters SOS Save Our Stories interview with Elsie Campbell. Elsie is in Dodge City, Kansas, and I'm in Naperville, Illinois, so we are conducting this interview over the telephone. Today's date is March 14th, 2008. It is 2:01 in the afternoon, and we're doing a special Quilters SOS Save Our Story, which is based on the exhibition Alzheimer's Forgetting Piece by Piece. So, Elsie, tell me about your quilt Confusion that's in the exhibit.
Well, it's a small quilt kind of based on a Lone Star pattern, a variation on that. Do you want me to tell you a little bit about how I came up with this idea?
Please.
Well, I was right on a deadline for this one, and I couldn't come up with an idea. I personally, thank God, have never had any experience with this disease, other than through my son. My son, Terry, he came back from Europe, from a year in Europe, and went back to university looking for a job, and he found one, and his job was to live with and take care of some of the needs of a man who had early onset Alzheimer's. In payment, Terry got room and board and the use of a Jeep, Michael's Jeep, and that's the only contact I had. Terry did a lot of studying online, reading about the disease. He knew a whole lot more about it than I did, having lived with Michael for a year. And I called Terry and said, I'm stuck. I don't know what to do. I think what I'm going to do is make a Lone Star and maybe leave holes in it. And Terry stopped me right there, and he said, no, Mom, Alzheimer's is not holes. He said, it isn't like holes in your memory. And I said, okay, how would you describe it if you had it in one word? And he said, I'm going to think about that. And he called me back a little later and said, Mom, that word would be confusion. And that's where the title came from, and that's where I started to think about how I would illustrate confusion in a Lone Star type thing. And I did a little bit of reading online then too, and talking with Carrie, and Carrie really helped me a lot to develop this idea. But in the quilt, there's 8 points in a Lone Star. The two top points, one is perfect. Everything's in the right order and perfect. The one next, if you go clockwise around the star, the next one has a couple of pieces that are transposed. They're not in the right places. They're mixed up. And as you continue to go around it, it gets a little bit more mixed up, confused, and some of the pieces are turned wrong side out. Some of the seams are wrong side out. They're all over, and then pieces start to fall away and become misshapen. And at the bottom, the piece begins to lose the color. I started using the more pastel shades to where it would kind of just fade away. And then the pieces come apart, and then I added some pieces at the bottom to kind of look like they're lying on a table, like they've come all apart. However, the center diamonds are purple, if I remember correctly, and they remain until the very last diamond. They remain the same shape and just exactly right. They're supposed to represent the inner, the long-term memory, which is the last to go. You know, we remember our things from childhood more clearly sometimes than we do things from the day before. And with Alzheimer's, I think that's even exacerbated to where the long-term memory is the very last thing that a person retains. So those purple diamonds were to represent the long-term memory. I'm not sure what else. You know, that's basically a description of it. I've also used some hand stitching, embellishment, kind of primitive stitching, that sort of thing. It was a lot of fun. And once I got the idea as to how I wanted to do this, it went together in an afternoon. So that's about the quilt, I guess.
What do you plan to do with the quilt when it comes back?
Well, I'll probably want to, part of my trunk show, I go around the country and lecture and teach about quilting and stuff like that. And I will probably put it in one of my trunk shows and tell the story and spread the word about Ami's efforts and the organization that she has started to raise funds for research for Alzheimer's.
Tell me about your impressions of the exhibit.
Well, I've seen it more than once. The first time I saw it, I barely got past the third or fourth quilt. It's difficult to go through that exhibit and read all the stories that go with them. And you better have a box of Kleenexes with you. They're heart-wrenching. It was a very moving exhibit. I just think everybody should see it. The last time I saw it in person was at a quilt show last summer, I think it was, and I took a friend with me. And we ended up having a lot of the similar feelings. That was like the third or fourth time I viewed it, but it still moves me every time. And I see new things every time I look at it. New ideas, new details in each piece. And there was so much thought. Went into each piece. You know, representing an abstract idea is really, in my opinion, a difficult thing. I usually make traditional quilts, things that are very standard, I guess. Maybe not standard. What's the word I wanted to say? Well, they're not intended to be art or anything like that. They're just beautiful objects. But these quilts represent ideas that are abstract and in such a way that I think the meaning comes through even more than if you used words. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Makes a great deal of sense. There's a CD that accompanies the exhibit, and each quilt maker was asked to call Ami up on her telephone and record their artist statement. Tell me about that experience for you.
Well, it's a long time ago already.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It was just, it was nice. It was interesting. I have several copies of the CDs, and I've given them as gifts.
I thought it was rather clever of Ami to have an audio component.
What did you say?
I thought it was rather clever of Ami to have an audio component.
Absolutely. This whole thing was just like, I don't know where the spark comes from, but Ami is amazing. There's no other way to describe her. And her sense of humor is so fresh and quirky. I've always enjoyed being around her and seeing her. This was just a unique thing, and I know she was working through her own grieving over the loss of her mother's memories, you know, and her mother's support. I lost my own mother 5 years ago, and my mother was my biggest fan. And I'd get some award, or I'd be making a new quilt, and I'd find myself wanting to call my mom. And then I'd think, I can't call her anymore. And I'm sure Ami has the same feelings, only she's dealing with it even more intensely because her mother's physical body is still alive. But that lack of support, that, you know, the missing person is just really tough to deal with. And I'm sure that's what she's been working through.
Tell me about your interest in quilt making.
I've always had a needle in my hand. Mom said I was 18 months old the first time she put a needle in my hand. I can't remember not being able to sew. Mother was a dressmaker. She earned money by altering clothes and making clothes for other people. She paid for, I had two sisters, and we all took piano lessons, and we all played clarinet, and we all sang, and we all did all these things. And Mom used her sewing money so that we could have those things that were not necessary but were nice. So we always had several sewing machines going at one time, seems like, because we all sewed and made quilts. And basically, at that point, it was dressmaking. It was necessary for financial reasons, besides being pleasurable. Mom said she'd be sewing, and I'd sit at her feet and scream until she'd put a needle and thread in my hands, too, at a piece of fabric. So I can't remember not knowing how. It's like lifeblood. I don't think I could put it down. I've had several surgeries on my upper extremities over the last 8 years. I'm facing another one for a trigger finger here in the next month. And it's probably one of my biggest nightmares is not being able to use my hands or be able to sew. So these have to remind me that I am human and that I need to slow down and pace myself, because most of my surgeries have been because of repetitive motion injuries. So I'm learning, but it is something I cannot not do. I must sew. I must create, do something. Is that what you're wanting?
Yeah. Well, and tell me, okay, so expand upon this, because you are an award-winning quilt maker, you're a teacher, you're a writer, you're an editor. So tell me about those experiences and how they all relate.
Well, one thing kind of feeds into the other. I mean, the writer and editor is because I was a quilt maker. I'm not sure. I mean, I also have a master's degree in special education. My bachelor's degree is in several other fields. I've got two master's degrees in areas of SPED. But everything, I've also been an insurance agent. I've been a custom framer. I've had a custom frame shop and needlework and cross-stitch shop. I taught piano for 30 years. I taught swimming, and I was a lifeguard. I can't tell you. And a licensed daycare. I've done a lot of different things. But I always come back to needlework and sewing in some way, shape, or form. I think I'm kind of like a closet artist. I would love to be able to paint, and I've done some of that too, some watercolor and acrylic, fine art. But for me, there seems to be more satisfaction in the needle art.
Now, is confusion typical of your style?
Is confusion typical?
Mm-hmm.
No. Not at all. However, I've done a little. I'll try everything at least once. I can't say that. Confusion is not the kind of quilt I would put in a competition. There's a lot of art quilters out there that make fantastic stuff. I aspire to doing art quilts, and I have made a bunch, a bunch of them. But they're not the ones that would win the awards for me. I win awards basically for craftsmanship, because I'm very good at it. And I'm I feel like I've developed a great sense of color and so forth and value, which are really important. But confusion, as far as it's not what I'm known for, the art quilt type thing. But it was lots of fun. And I have done other work like that, commissioned work and so forth, but not, it's nothing that I usually do to show for competition or anything like that, or teach. That's kind of what you're looking for there.
Mm-hmm. How many hours a week do you quilt?
You know what? If I stopped to count the hours, I'd be wasting minutes. I could be using quilting. You know, if it, when you're enjoying yourself, and when you're, that's what quilting is. It's a pleasure to do. It doesn't matter how much time or how little time you spend on it. That has nothing to do with anything. People ask me, how many hours did it take you to make that quilt? And I said, what? You know, it's like, to me, that just seems like such a question. Like, where did that come from? It has no meaning here.
Well, and I always answer that question by telling people whatever my age is at that time. How long did it take you?
Yeah, well, however old you are, that makes sense. Yeah, 52 or
50 yeah,
years or
right,
whatever it is.
Right, whatever it is. Because, you know, I think it's a process and it's ongoing and, you know.
Yep.
So it took me 52 years to get here to make this quilt.
Yeah. And I always have, like, oh, we don't even bother counting UFOs anymore either, you know, those unfinished objects. That doesn't matter either. The process, I learn something new from everything I do, and I have to keep thinking and keep the wheels turning upstairs. Maybe I'm preventing Alzheimer's. Because every time you make something new, you have to rethink and think, did that work as well as I'd like? I teach gifted children at public school. That's what I've been doing for the last 4 years. Well, actually, I've been doing it about 10 years, but off and on for the last 15 years. And the Bloom's taxonomy, there's all these different levels. And one, the first one is knowledge, and that means just you can recite facts. And then there's comprehension. You understand those facts, and you can relate them. And then there's synthesis, evaluation, and so forth. And when I'm working in quilting, I'm working in the upper-level thinking skills of evaluation and synthesis. You're pulling everything you've ever learned together to make a new product. When you're finished, you look at it and say, oh, this went really well. I really like what happened here. But I think I could have done this better. How could I do it better? Why would I do it that way? And that's evaluation, and that's the highest level thinking skills. I think probably with Alzheimer's, those are the first skills to go. It's a judgment in the upper level thinking skills. And I've heard that you can maybe sometimes keep your mental health or your brain working if you exercise. So I do a lot of exercising. I probably quilt, to go back to your original question here, probably I am working in quilting-related things probably 60 to 70 hours a week, 8 to 10 hours a day at least. You know, if I'm not actively doing something with my hands quilt-related, I am thinking about it, or I am writing about it, or I'm on the Internet, or that sort of thing. So if I had young children, I wouldn't be able to spend all that time, but my kids are grown. And my husband is very relaxed about the housekeeping and everything else, and he does a lot of the cooking and everything. So I'm kind of free right now to indulge in what I love to do.
How wonderful.
Yeah, it really is.
So what does your family think of your quilt making?
Well, they've always been very tolerant and supportive also. I have two sons and now a daughter-in-law. For example, about 5 years ago, I won one of the top awards at the AQS show in Paducah, Kentucky. Big, big, big surprise. And my son and daughter-in-law were just moving from Memphis, Tennessee to Ottumwa, Iowa the weekend prior to this show. And I called my sons up to tell them about this award. The first son, the quilt, I had just told him he could have that quilt. I put their name on all the quilts that I make. And they'll have that quilt when I pass on, not before. And Kelly said, well, that's okay, Mom. He says it'll be in the museum. I can go visit it once in a while. I said, yes, that's right, Kelly. I'll have to make you another one. So he was fine with that. And he understood how important that was. My younger son told his wife of about 6 months at that time, pack your bag, we're going. And my daughter-in-law had no clue what she was in for. She had never seen a quilt show, not like Paducah or anywhere else. And they drove 11 hours to get to Paducah so they could be with me and to witness and see the quilt and everything like that, see the show. And her mind was just totally blown away. She had never seen anything like that. She had no idea. I mean, she comes from quilting background. Her grandmother's all quilted, her mom quilts and all that. But she had no idea that quilts could look like that, the competition quilts, the art quilts and so forth. Carrie also got to hang the 100 best quilts when they were in Europe with the International Quilt Association. He was living in France at the time and studying chemical engineering in Nancy, which is near Strasbourg. And Carrie Bresnahan from IQA hired Carrie and five of his friends to come up, hang the show, and act as interpreters and help with the takedown and all that. They're American kids in Europe, and that was kind of a neat deal for him. So, you know, every little bit, I think my sons helped educate their friends, too, about quilting and how quilts are art in a lot of ways. So they're very supportive. My husband does my videotaping. He did my website, which right now needs a little bit of maintenance work, but Ken also teaches public school, so summers are when he does his work on things for me. He sometimes travels with me, sets up my media equipment, hauls my bags around and stuff, packs up the cars. And he seems to be very proud. He never exactly tells me that. But I hear from other people that he brags about me a lot, so that makes me feel good.
So whose works are you drawn to and why?
I love it all. Let me see if I can go back. You know, there's a lot of people who are influential in my career. In 1992, I entered a contest, the AQS contest, and my quilt was accepted, and I actually traveled to Paducah to see it there. I walked into the museum of the American Quilter Society, and there, with all the spotlights on it and everything, was one of Carol Breyer Fowler's work called Cosmic Pelican. The thing glowed. It brought tears to my eyes because at that point, I grew up with quilts on every bed and everything like that. I didn't know quilts could look like that. And I was moved to tears. And I, at that point, it became an ambition. I wanted a quilt in that museum also. I thought, I'll never be able to do this. This is a goal, though. I'm going to work towards that. So it's a real thrill. Now I do have one in that museum. About that same time, I think it was 1993, I was a church youth group sponsor, and I had my sons and several other teenagers, and we went to St. Louis for a church world conference. And I'd drag a quilt along, and I would be sitting in the hallway and quilting, waiting on kids to get done with activities and such. And this young man came and just stood there quietly and watched me stitch. I thought, this is interesting, you know. I didn't realize, but he just was so intent on watching me every stitch. And he just got closer in and closer to my work, watching everything, never said a word. Then all of a sudden he looked at me and he said, is that reverse applique? And I went, oh, my gosh. He was kind of dressed like with a cowboy necktie and the hat and all that. And this cowboy knows, well, we struck up a conversation. Can you guess who that was?
Ricky Timms.
You got it. He was not known in the quilting world. He had just begun to quilt, and I had just started the inner contest. And that's exactly who it was. And we've been friends ever since. Run into each other at quilt shows and such. So it's been kind of a neat way to watch his career skyrocket like it has. Matter of fact, we're going to Pueblo tonight, and we're going to have dinner with him and Justin tomorrow night in La Vida. So kind of excited about that. But he in 1998, met him in Paducah, and gave me his usual hug, and he kind of whispered in my ear, Elsie, I've done it, I've done it, I quit my day job. I'm quilting full time. And, you know, him doing that kind of encouraged me when my opportunity came about a year and a half later to do the same thing. So in a lot of ways, he really has been influential in my career and my courage to do what I'm doing also. Another couple of people, Diane Godinsky's work has always inspired me tremendously. And I had the privilege of taking a machine quilting class from her a few years back. I had never really machine quilted. I was not satisfied. But after class with her and a little practice, the new quilt I've got out there on the competition is getting best machine workmanship. It's been in 5 shows, come home with 6 ribbons so far, and 3 of those have been best machine workmanship awards. So I'm really thrilled. I've got to ship it out today to Quilters Heritage Celebration in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. I'll be there with it in about a week and a half. So, and my quilting, I never dreamed quilting would take me to Rio de Janeiro, but I taught quilting in Rio de Janeiro a few years back, too. So this has been an amazing thing to me. And France, I taught quilting in France. I never dreamed my quilting would take me these places. So it's an incredible thrill to me.
So tell me about teaching in a foreign country. How is it different?
Well, probably each country is a little bit different. In France, I didn't really have an interpreter, but it was amazing to me. You speak quilting, you don't really need it. You know, you can demonstrate and they get it. And I was just amazed at how little importance language is. You really, a lot of it is demonstration and visual. And I think most quilters are visual learners. And it was amazing. Rio de Janeiro was another experience. I did have an interpreter there who was an avid quilter. And some of the time I felt like she was giving them how she would do it rather than telling them what I was saying. You understand what I'm saying?
Oh, yes.
The best interpreter I had down there was one who knew nothing about quilting. The ones who knew something about quilting tended to color it their way.
Mm-hmm. I've had similar experiences teaching in different countries.
Yeah.
Very true.
Yeah. But Rio was it was delightful. I just can't tell you what a thrill that was. I was very, very, very surprised. Where we live, over half the population here in Dodge City is Hispanic, Mexican. They speak Spanish. They don't speak much English. Down there, they're all black hair, brown eyed, brown skin, all this. When I got down there, the women I was teaching were all European descent. They looked like me, you know. I was shocked to see, to learn that Rio de Janeiro and that area of Brazil was settled about the same time the U.S. was with Europeans. The architecture, a lot of the architecture looked like Europe. The food was absolutely fabulous. I had not anticipated it being European in nature, and it is. The breads and the meats and everything were just like I had been transplanted to Europe. So I had not anticipated that. Another thing that fascinated me down there was the favelas, the shanty towns. Masses and masses and masses of people, millions of people in Rio live on the sides of the mountains down there in shacks that are basically just boxes. It amazed me, though, you know, how innovative and how creative people can be in how they live with so few things and the needs that human beings actually need a whole lot less than we think we do to survive.
What are quilts like there? What did their quilts look like?
Their quilts were, some of them were pure and simple copies of American-made quilts. There was a barn quilt, there was a pattern quilt, there were different quilts. And for me, it was difficult for me to see these people with their own cultures and their own heritage and stuff trying to imitate our country and folk art style. However, there were some very unique quilts and very, very much a local lore. And one quilt that fascinated me had the ladies. She spoke limited English, but she wanted to tell me the whole entire story. It was a group quilt. And they had different blocks, and it was from their province or state of Brazil. And about the only thing I could really remember or really understand, she wanted me definitely to know about this little brown bird. He makes a little mud hut for his mate. They mate for life. And it has a little door in it. She can go in and out of her mud hut, lays her eggs, and they both tend the babies and everything. However, if he thinks she's been cheating on him or seeing another male bird, he'll shove her in the little mud hut and close the door off with mud, and she will die in there. And she wanted me to know the story of that little brown bird that they mate for life. However, there was another one that had a snake on it, a kind of electric white ghost snake, they called it. And the gist of the story is that this was an old woman who got lost in the Amazon rainforest, and she turned into this boa constrictor, this gigantic snake, and she became the guardian of the forest. And there was a long story about the snake, and there was this beautiful quilt with a snake. Another amazing story for me was there was a Lone Star quilt. I'm drawn to Lone Stars anyway. Beautifully made machine quilt. It machined everything, little machine embroidery, butterflies all over it, all this fascinating things. I ate breakfast with the woman who made it. She was a very plain and simple lady, no makeup, you know, clothes not so nice anyway. And she didn't speak much English, but I got enough of it. She lives in the Amazon forest. She loved birds, fed birds, parrots, everything. She was telling me all about the birds. And then I asked her about her quilt. She said she has no running water and no electricity. I said, how did you make your quilt with no electricity? You know, this is a machine quilted quilt that could compete in Paducah anywhere else. It's fabulous. And I got the gist of the thing is she has a gasoline generator in her backyard. And when she wanted to sew, she would fire up her generator so she'd have electricity to sew, and that's the only electricity she ever used.
Wow.
Yeah, human spirit again. If we want to, there's a way. Where there's a will, there's a way, that old saying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but there was some very unique quilts. The colors seemed to be brighter to me. Great sense of color. Purer. There wasn't any of that grayed down, toned down colors unless it was in quilts imitating U.S. style. Fascinating to see.
Do you think that your quilts reflect your community or region?
Dodge City's a cow town. I've made a few cowboy quilts, but that's not me. I do them because they're ones that people like to see around here. I think we have some regional differences in the U.S. I lived in the Northeast for a while. They're certainly different than California style. I haven't even thought about that. I grew up Mennonite, and I'm totally drawn to the Amish and the black and the bright colors, you know, paired with black, where black just makes colors glow. And I'm drawn to solids. I love to work in the solids because I found out early on in my competition life that the thing the judges liked best were my quilting stitches. And for quilting stitches to show, you need to work in solid colors. So a lot of my award winners, well, matter of fact, nearly, I think all but one of my award-winning quilts are made out of solids or hand dyes that read like solids. I use very few prints in my competition quilts. However, I dearly love to make scrap quilts with thousands of different fabrics in them. And those are the ones that I just have fun making, and those are the ones that are on the beds, and those are the ones that I give away, and those are the ones that are in my trunk show. My best trunk show, I think, is my scrap quilts, Innovations and Renovations Scrap Quilt Talk. So I'm kind of a jack of all trades, but if you go to a show and see one of my quilts in competition, they're probably going to be solid colors with radial symmetry, like a Lone Star, that sort of thing. But what I make for pleasure aren't necessarily those. I don't know if I've got a regional flavor or style. It's just, I just like to make quilts.
Describe your studio.
What?
Describe your studio.
Well, it's a kind of oozes over into the rest of the house. Right now I have a large bedroom on the second floor. I have a very in an old, very large house. I have four gigantic windows that stretch basically from the ceiling to the floor, so I have lots and lots of natural light, and I overlook the whole neighborhood. It's kind of fun to look out and see everything. I turned one wall. What I did was I took a quilt batting, a very dense cotton batting, and glued and nailed it to some wooden slats, and then I nailed the slats into the wall and put trim around it, and that's my design wall. I have an old library table that I bought for $10 at a high school auction one time. It has a lot of nice graffiti carved into the top of it. It's very portable. The legs, you can remove them. They just screw on real good, and it's very sturdy. It's solid oak, and I cover that with a bunch of cutting mats. I have two very large cutting mats I put on it, so it's, you know, so I don't have to look at the graffiti that teenagers carved into the top. I have a large ironing board with storage units underneath that I use. Lots of shelving, and I like open shelving. I know it's probably not the healthiest for my fabric, but I seem to thrive on visual stimulation. I want to see what I've got. I also have a large walk-in closet that I've lined with shelves. I do a lot of hand dyeing, and I've got all my hand dyes starched and ready to cut, hanging on hangers in that walk-in closet, and then the walls are lined with shelves. What I really like is I have my own bathroom, full bath there. The only time that bathroom ever gets used by other people is when we have guests in the house, and my daughter-in-law particularly, she likes having her own bathroom up there, so she goes up to my sewing room or her bathroom when she stays here. The sewing table, I have more than a few Bernina sewing machines. One's usually in my sewing table, and one's I bring up and put up and down for embroidery, and then I've got several old Berninas, 830, 532, some of those models that are in my closet. that I get out for guests. Sometimes if we're sewing together, we can set those up on the tables downstairs and work all over the house. My yardage sits in the walk-in closet, and my fat quarters are all on the shelves. All my books are spread out. I've got one whole wall lined with library books in my bedroom, another half wall in my office, and then I'm starting to fill up shelves in my family room, so I kind of collect things like that. I have a whole cabinet full of unfinished quilt tops and pieces and things like that, ideas. My office, I have another walk-in closet that I've lined with shelves where I put all my class supplies and teaching samples. My guest bedroom has another closet that's full of inventory that I sell online and books and such. And that's where I store all my finished quilts and my trunk shows. And then I have a basement storage room where I've got two pallets of books that went out of print. I bought them all, so, you know, it just kind of oozes into every room in the house, I think. That's enough description for
it? Oh, that's great. What do you think is the biggest challenge confronting quilt makers today?
Quilt makers in general?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I hadn't thought about it in general. For me, maybe it's narrowing it down to something and trying to, instead of being a jack of all trades, trying to do something well. I haven't quite figured out yet what it is that I do the best or that I want to do. I mean, I want to do it all. And sometimes I get a lot of scatter in what I'm doing, and I think maybe I need to be able to organize and narrow what I'm doing. I don't know. I sometimes wonder if we're getting too many large shows all over, because some of the shows are having a struggle now filling classes. Quilters seem to be able to travel and go to all these shows. In this particular area, we've had trouble keeping quilt shop. We just have a new quilt shop that opened up about 20 miles from Dodge City, but she's the only quilt shop for probably a 100-mile radius.
What?
We have no quilt shop, so I have to drive 150 miles to a quilt shop of any significant size at all.
Now, why do you think that is?
That is because we're over half Hispanic, and the Hispanic people, it looks like we have a large population base. We do. But these people are young, and they have 10 and 12 kids, and they're busy trying to feed those mouths and keep a roof over their head, and they have no interest in needle arts or needle crafts. And if they did, they don't have the time or the money to invest in it. Because it is an investment.
And not a small one.
What?
And not a small one.
And not a small one. And it's not part of their culture either. Whereas I grew up German Mennonite, and it is a part of my culture.
What advice would you offer someone starting out?
Read books. You know, buy all the, get the books, that the how-to books. The pattern books, start off slowly. Go to the quilt shops, if there's one in your area. Talk with the owners and take classes. Take all the classes you can possibly afford and have time for. Buy the best. You pay for what you get. There's no sense in buying a $100 sewing machine at the W store and being frustrated, you know, and you'll give up immediately because the machine is so frustrating to use. Buy the best sewing machine you can possibly afford, because you'll be using that for years and years and years and years. It becomes your best friend. The same thing with fabric. Buy the best fabric you can afford. In general, you pay for what you get. If you buy $2 a yard fabric, at the discount shops, it may very well be that that fabric is going to fall apart in a year or two or three, or it's so flimsy that it will fray, and your seams won't hold up, or it'll be difficult to work with because it doesn't have enough thread count. It's important to use the best materials because you're going to be spending hours and hours making something beautiful. There's no sense in wasting a few pennies on materials and tools.
What do you think makes a great quilt?
Well, I know when I'm judging, I know what happens when you're judging at a large show. You've got to have something that's attention-grabbing. It has to be stunning first. It has to be a design with contrast and beauty. Colors are important, but I think value is even more important than color. There has to be value. There has to be an idea behind it, something that at first glance is going to grab the viewer and draw them in. Visual impact. If you don't have visual impact, they're not going to bother looking at the workmanship, no matter how meticulous it is. The visual impact is all important. You must have an idea. You must carry it through with value and color, repetition, whatever it needs to be. Then you will be drawn in. Then it's important that your workmanship be meticulous if you're going into competition. I think a lot of people are their own best critics, but they don't know it. You know what went well with your quilt. You know what you did best. You know what you need help with and what you struggled with. If you struggle with applique, start taking applique classes, start buying books about applique, start practicing applique until you are satisfied what you're doing is good. Same thing with piecing, whatever. Quilting, the finishing process. The last quilt show I judged, there were some gorgeous quilts with fantastic, meticulous workmanship, and they failed to bind it well. The bindings were askew and fat and skinny in places. They weren't filled to the edge. If you have spent hours and hours and hours piecing and appliquing a beautiful quilt, and in more hours meticulously quilting it, don't ruin it by doing a shoddy job on the edge. The edge is just as important. Every step along the way has to be just as well done as the others. It's very important that every step of the process be well done. And the only way to get better is to study it out, practice, take classes, and do the very best work on every piece you do.
Are there any aspects of quilt making that you don't enjoy?
I'm trying to think if there's a part that's my least favorite.
Obviously, you don't have one.
I'm struggling with that one because every stage is... You know, it's kind of like falling in love. If I have a good design, it almost makes itself because I can't put it down. Now, I don't think I can't think of anything
it's quite all right.
I really, really enjoy every part of it. I'm trying to think of it. I do know one that I made that I didn't have problems with it, but I didn't particularly enjoy making three-dimensional flowers. It was a commissioned work. She came with me. She wanted 3D flowers on it. And I wasn't going to do it quite the way she wanted. I did it my way. But I ended up using Joan Shea's petal play, where you use heat and bond ultra, and then you curl it around pencils or you shape it. They turned out beautifully. And the person was just thrilled to pieces with it, and she had it in a couple of private shows, and I can't remember what all she did, but she's always making sure that I know how much she appreciated it, but I didn't particularly enjoy doing it.
Well, we've been talking for 45 minutes, believe it or not. I always give people an opportunity to share anything that they would like that we haven't covered, so this is your chance.
I'm not sure what else to say. I enjoy talking about my work. And, you know, traveling and teaching is a wonderful experience. However, I have come to the point where I love to teach people all the things that I know, but I do not enjoy the travel part of the travel. That's been a little tough. You know, if anybody ever decides they want to do this, they really got to have stamina and, believe it or not, physical strength to haul those bags and equipment around. And airports are not fun anymore. It's a real struggle. I understand the security and all that, but you never think about those things as being part of a quilting world. But when you go into it as a profession, there's a lot of stuff goes into this that you didn't bargain for. And you have to think about that. It's not all about making quilts. It's also about bookkeeping and making your arrangements for hotels and airline tickets and getting all your stuff there and seeing that you've got everything you need in a suitcase. So, you know, I think it's all worth it though, because we make our connections and to meet all these different quilters from all over. I've never met a quilter I didn't like. To take off from Will Rogers, you know, his old saying. So I think that's probably the best of the best here. Our quilters worldwide are just eager, happy, busy, industrious people, and I love them.
Well, I think it's a great way to close.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for taking your time to do this interview with me, and we are going to end, and it's 2:48.